Texas' socioeconomic environment has undergone some fairly interesting changes. Now, the physical environment doesn't tend to change massively. The lakes, yes, and one of my students said, why don't you have us memorize where the lakes are? Eh, you can look that up. You know, it's not that big a deal. It is a big deal, but this isn't a course in Texas geography. It's just the key stuff we need to know. So we'll look at population, racial, ethnic mix, and economics. Now that's a pretty tall order if we did it in great detail, but if we kiss the topic, look at the essentials, I call it the bikini lecture, it covers the essentials, then we'll be fine. All right, what do you know about the population of Texas? You know, fascinatingly enough, in 1846, when Texas joined the Union, or Union joined Texas, whichever you happen to take the point of view on it, Texas and Iowa had almost identical populations. Texas and Iowa are almost sister states. They joined the Union within a year of each other. Had almost identical populations, close to identical populations, nowhere close to the same size. Have you ever been to Iowa? Okay. You can drive all the way across Iowa in about the same length of time as it takes you to drive from Beaumont to Austin.
Roughly, depending on traffic.
Oh yeah, it depends on which road you take. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they've got some nice interstates too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one good interstate.
The rest is all crap.
I-80. When Texas and Iowa joined the Union, they had almost identical populations. Is that true today? Mm-hmm. No. Iowa's got a population of slightly over 2 million people. Yeah. Texas, on the other hand, how many of you know? Within a million or two. Within a million or two, I'll make it five, within 5 million.
23?
Pretty dang close. We'll give you a check on that one, okay? So the population of Texas has increased virtually 10 times, and the population of Iowa has only doubled during that period. We're going to have to look at the political, social, and economic consequences of that population change, and of course the distribution of that population has changed as well. And then we'll play with the economics. Fair enough? We'll put the pieces together. Do they impact upon the politics of Texas? You know, that one of my father's favorite expressions when you ask a question that was obvious was, is a pig's rear pork? Had a slightly different way of putting it, but this is class. So what are the key points? Population of Texas has increased significantly. Migration and natural increase are about equal and have been about equal for a couple of decades. Texas is now the second most populated state in the Union. We are no longer primarily cowboys and cowgirls. Our population is about 80% urban and moving toward the 90% level. The population is not evenly distributed. East of the Balcones Escarpment, remember where the Balcones Escarpment is? 80% of the population of Texas. There's lots of Texas where there ain't a whole lot of people. Growth has been primarily in the urban corridors, and rural and West Texas have lost and continue to lose population. And that increase in population, increase in loss of population has accelerated rather than slowed in recent years. So these are the key points. Everybody got them pretty well down? So let's fill in the blanks. If we chart the population growth of Texas from 1870 to 2010, look at what's happened. Yeah, and when did the population growth really take off? About the 1940s, see?
Yeah.
If you want, now we're going to go through this very, very quickly. Slideshow. Oh, our websites have merged it. Dadgummit, it was working perfectly earlier. They just played games on me. This is an extremely good website. It's called the Texas State Demographer. And you can frankly spend hours with this website if you happen to have any particular use for it. Fair enough? So they've changed the slideshow, which I had. Let me... Well, I'm going to have to come back to this later. It was working perfectly at the beginning of the semester, and now they have, 2 weeks ago, and now they've merged it. That just shows you that you need to look at something just before class begins to make sure that they haven't screwed you up. But that's as okay. Now, if somebody asks you the question, what's the population of Texas going to be like in 2040? And it depends on what assumptions you make, right? So let's look at the difference. This comes from the Texas State Data Center, the demographer's office. If we had no migration into the state at all, if Donald Trump were successful and he built his 40-foot wall between here and Mexico and we had no migration, of course the problem with that is all migration is not from Mexico. A substantial part of it is from Asia, Eastern Europe, and I don't think that wall is going to have much help there. And did you know that about 70% of the people who are illegally in the United States don't cross the border illegally? They come in on legal visas and so forth and simply overstay the visas. And I don't think the wall is going to do much good for that. At any rate, no migration at all. And that's no migration from outside as well as migration from inside, then the population of Texas would probably only be about 26 million by 2040, given the fact that we're starting at the present time at about 23, 24 million. That's almost no growth at all. If, on the other hand, we had the same rate of growth that we had had between 1990 and the year 2000, the population of Texas would be close to 50 million. And then there's these other scenarios. The other two are the most likely scenarios, which means somewhere in the vicinity of a 40 million. Okay, can I pick on you for a second? You're responsible for planning transportation for Texas. It takes 10 years to plan and build a major highway, even if you have the money. Are we going to calculate no growth, in which case we don't have to build any highways? Are we going to say that the kind of growth that we've had over the last 20, 30 years is going to continue? Are we going to look at the decade between 90 and 2000, which was the spurt period, and plan for 50 million? It takes about 8 years to train a doctor completely. Mm-hmm. How many doctors do we need to plan for?
A lot.
And medical schools, blah, 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 blah. Everybody can begin to understand the significance of what we're looking at when we start looking at these population projections. Mm-hmm. You got to make some plans. Mm-hmm. And the plans are based on the assumptions about what the population's going to be. So you ask the Texas State demographer, okay, what's the population going to look like in 2040? It says, well, it depends on which assumptions you take. Now I'm making, let me get off on a tangent for a second. I'm making an assumption. If I came from a family which did not live much past its early 70s, I would have retired 6 years ago. So I'd have some time, you know, free before I drop dead. Now, I'll play no games with you. I'm 73 years old. Not many people are still working full-time at 73. I feel fine. I'm doing well. Don't have no complaints. And if I'm looking at the potentiality of living till I'm in my mid-90s, I really don't want to sit around and do nothing for 20 years. So I'm making some assumptions, aren't I? I could be wrong. I could be run over by a truck tomorrow and dead. Whatever. But you have to make assumptions when you make plans. So the big question is, what kinds of assumptions will the legislature make? Will the people who are planning, you begin to understand how this affects politics in Texas? To figure out, make your best guess of what it's going to look like in 20 years, or 10 years, or 5 years. Okay, let's keep moving. This again comes from the U.S. Census Bureau, put together by the Texas State Data Center. And I do not expect you to memorize these numbers, but let's just look at them. If we take the period between 60 and 70, that was a period in which most of the increase in Texas came from people having babies. 93%. Natural increase. Our population changed by 24%. As you begin to look, what significant thing began in the early 1960s that's going to start impacting rather significantly this figure, this percentage?
The population.
Yeah, but we're talking about population. Why does the percentage due to natural increase, that's people having babies, mm-hmm, start to significantly decline by the 1970s? What sociological and medical changes take place?
Birth control.
Yes, improved birth control. And the other factor?
Abortion.
Education for women.
Oh, okay.
When I graduated from high school over 50 years ago, what was the career path most young ladies took?
Secretary.
I'm sorry.
Secretary or housewife?
Well, if they're going to work, secretary, nurse, some occupation like that. What percentage of them, other than on a temporary basis, would actually end up in careers? Teaching, nursing. The first year I taught at Sam Houston State, which was 1963, 80% of the young ladies who were enrolled at Sam Houston State were in two different programs, nursing or education. That was their career path. And the campus was 80 to 85% male. Any changes? Big time. So, first off, natural increase begins to drop off. If you really want to have fun with this, take a look at what's known as the raw birth rate. That is the number of children that a woman is suspected to have. And of course, it differs by different socio-economic, racial, ethnic, if you want to really. Any of you had sociology? You spend a bunch of time looking at that, don't you? And how it changes. What is the most dramatic, which group has seen the most dramatic decrease in the raw birth rate in Texas? Can I pick on you? And there's a reason I'm picking on you. What do you guess it is? Come on. Don't let me know. Let me pick on you then.
I don't know.
Hispanics. The raw birth rate among Hispanics 30 years ago was about 4.5. Average 4 to 5 children. It's dropped down. It's still above 2.1 something is replacement level. It's still above replacement level, but nowhere near doubling the population. And what brings that, what's brought that about? It's education. Education is the single best way to reduce the raw birth rate. a lot of reasons for that. If this were a sociology class, we'd go into it in great detail. Just trust me, or I'll show you how to find it out. Fair enough? So we look at it now. Natural increase is only one decade between 1990 and 2000, and then 60 to 70, in which, or 70 to 80, pardon me, in which migration produced more people. And then we got to ask the question, migration from where? Don't assume it's foreign migration. Between the 50s and the 70s, the biggest percentage of migration in Texas was from other states into the state of Texas, as the economy of Texas changed. And we'll talk about that later. You begin to see how all these pieces are connected. Connect the dots. Not yet. Give me some response. I mean, I can go with yes, I can go with no, but I have a hard time with. Texas rate of growth between 2000 and 2010, Texas gained 4.2 million people. California was next with 3.3, Florida 2.8. But where's New York? It is on this chart. Huh. Did somebody screw up?
No.
I got a little story to tell you. In 2001, my wife and I did a bicycle ride across northern New York, and we ended in Albany. Albany is the state capital of New York. And whenever I'm in the state capital of any state, I have to visit the state capital. It's me, and she knows it. She goes to quilt shops, I go to state capitals. It works. Guess what? There are a hell of a lot more quilt shops than there are state capitals. At any rate, the 2000 census had just come out, and New York had almost no gain, whatever, just nothing. And I dropped by the legislative research wing and was talking with a couple of young fellows who were there, who were young, you know, maybe they were in their 40s and 50s, but from my perspective, that's young. Talking about New York's situation, and I couldn't help it. I just couldn't help it. I had to be a Texan. I said, well, of course, you know, Texas had all of this growth, and New York has had virtually none. And they said, man, are we so happy. Uh-huh. Said, yeah, we can get caught up. Said, the thing that you didn't pay attention to is the overall wealth increase. New York had a significantly greater gain in wealth, but almost no gain in population. Our average income went up by blah, 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 blah. So we can take care of those educational, transportation, water supply, other needs. And while you're struggling to just keep up with population growth, we have a chance to improve the quality of the services that we're rendering. New York, of course, and he couldn't help it, he said, New York, of course, ranks substantially ahead of Texas in all the educational measurements, which are percentage of students who graduated from high school, scores on SATs, percentage who graduate from state universities, blah, blah, blah. And I couldn't. So you lie. He was right. We've been struggling to keep up, and they've been struggling to improve. Now, can we continue that rate of growth? It's a good question. If we look at the estimated population growth by counties, guess what? In the area east of I-35, see, that's I-35, it really doesn't go straight like that, but it's close enough, fair enough. There's only 40% of the land, but 85% of the population, and 92% of the population growth. Do I want you to memorize those statistics? No. No. No reason to. You can look them up. This comes from the U.S. Census Bureau, and it's reported by the Texas State Data Center. And that's where I stole the chart. And if we look at urban population, we're between 85 and 90% urban now. I can only take it to 2000. The data for 2010 is not yet available. I don't know why. They're to keep dragging their heels on it. All right, let's look at the percentage of growth. Red means you're losing population. Blue means you're gaining. Notice that there are few counties east of the Balcones Escarpment that are red, primarily here in the South Texas Plain, the southern, the coastal belt between Houston and Corpus Christi, deep East Texas. Those are rural counties. In almost every instance, those are rural counties, dependent on agriculture primarily for their income. But the number of counties in West Texas that have lost population are only seen minimal gain, with the exception of El Paso. Dominate, do they not? There's one blue county, either light blue or dark blue, west of the Balcones Escarpment. So do you want to get into a real estate business in West Texas? Total population. Where are all the people? Pretty easy to determine. East of the Balcones Escarpment. Can you name the major population centers of Texas, Ms. Blackwell?
The major.
I'll bet you can.
Populations.
The Houston-Galveston Metroplex, right?
Yeah.
With the biggest percentage of growth occurring either directly south or directly north. The Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, the San Antonio-Austin-Waco. I think I briefly mentioned in class at the end of the slideshow that at the rate things are going, this is going to be a solid megalopolis all the way from Austin, San Antonio to Waco in another 20, 25 years. Good, bad? I don't know. If we put the population, if we took the Blackland Prairie, this is the Blackland Prairie, remember the Blackland Prairie? If we took the Blackland Prairie and made it a state, it would be one of the 10 most populous states in the Union. Kind of scary, isn't it? In a way. Obviously, where the growth has been, where the loss has been, sticks out like a sore thumb. All right, we beat this horse to death, all right? I think you got the picture, or you've gotten all the pictures. Percent change in loss of urban open space, that's fine. When we start talking about trying to preserve open space in the Houston, Galveston, Dallas-Fort Worth area, Austin-San Antonio area, we're rapidly running out of open space. Now, why does anybody care? How do you recharge your aquifers? You don't do it with concrete and parking lots on top of it. And we're dependent on aquifers for a chunk of our water. All right, let's turn our attention to population, some just general stuff. There are very few Native Americans left in Texas. There are only three tribes that have reservations, the Alabama Coshatti and the Kickapoo Antigua. They're out in the Kickapoo Antigua are out in the El Paso region. And they're all talking about wanting to have their own casinos to help support them. I got into an interesting argument several years ago with a guy who seemed to believe that Texas had no Spanish heritage. I'm not sure where he had studied Texas history. And logic doesn't always work with that kind of person, but I asked him a question. Can you name the major rivers of Texas for me?
Well,
okay, how about from west to east? Can you name the major rivers?
Guadalupe.
Rio Grande.
Guadalupe.
Yeah, let's had a few Pecos.
Colorado.
You left one out in the way. Yeah, the Nueces.
Okay.
Colorado.
Then the Guadalupe. And you got
Brazos.
Brazos and then
Trinity.
Trinity.
San Jacinto. Natchez. Sabine. Are any of those English names?
No. Well, all of the rivers have Spanish names.
I'm sorry, say again.
I said all of the rivers have Spanish names except the river. But
yeah, the only non-Spanish, we left out Pernales, Frio, Comal, some of the minor ones, right? Not many of them have Rio Diablo. Rio Diablo, the Devil's River.
Mm-hmm.
We only have a few that have Anglican names like Canadian, Sulphur. Okay. And of course there are no Spanish named cities in Texas, are there? San Marcos, San Antonio. I always found it fun. One of the biggest cities in South Texas is Edinburgh, which is obviously not Spanish. If this were a Texas history course, we'd talk about the course of Spanish colonization, how the Spanish came in and established missions, presidios, rancheros. They set up what amounts to counties. A lot of the cultural and legal traditions of Texas are Spanish in origin. We'll talk about some of those when we get to the Constitution. Mexican colonization in Texas really never took off. ¿Por qué? Now, I warn you, I will frequently, rather than just ask why, I'll sometimes ask you ¿por qué? Which means why in Spanish. Now, I had a young fellow in my class several years ago, and I won't say he was the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he was a nice kid. And he finally came up after class and said, "Mr. Waddell, why do you keep saying porky, porky, porky?" It was all I could do to suppress a laugh. Porque. What, Miss Sargent, can I pick on you for a second?
Okay.
The Spanish never really made a go of colonization in Texas. Why?
I don't know.
Okay. How many of you join her? She said, "I don't know." Never feel ashamed to say, "I don't know." That is the beginning of learning. I don't know. There's nothing worse than a person who knows something that's wrong and won't admit it. You can't educate a person who knows for sure something, but it's wrong. It's hopeless. What was the model of Spanish colonization, which they followed through virtually all of Latin America?
Missions.
Well, they used the missions to convert, and only a handful of the Indians in East Texas were willing to be converted. But there had to be something economically to sustain those missions. Agriculture, they could grow enough food to be able to feed themselves, but no transportation system, no markets, so growing a surplus just meant it went to waste. There was no place to serve it, to sell it. Texas was isolated. Texas had no transportation. Now, we play to look at rivers, right? Do we have any really major navigable rivers in Texas? No. Rivers in Texas served neither as means of transportation nor barriers, either way. What's fun is to take the map and look at how few crossings there really are of the Mississippi River from New Orleans all the way up to Milwaukee. It is a major project to build a bridge across the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. Expensive. It's not something you can just run out there and plop one down. Texas rivers don't really afford much of an obstacle. It's pretty easy to build bridges across rivers in Texas. So when we look at the fact that, I mean, ranching was invented in Texas by the Mexicans, by the Spanish. It was in their blood. Any of you ever go to a rodeo? Name me some of the, so you know something about horses, and name me the...
I just went because the guy was cute. I went with so.
Lariats, stirrup, virtually chaps, which is...
Virtually all of that equipment that you're talking about has Spanish names, doesn't it? And it's derived from the horse culture that Spanish had. Just American cowboys are just as American as the vaqueros, from whom they learned to herd cattle. So the Spanish just didn't make an economic, the Mexicans and Spanish simply just couldn't make an economic go of colonization in Texas. When the Anglos came in, they brought with them, what was the crop that the Anglos primarily used, particularly in East Texas? Almost exclusively in East Texas.
Corn.
Cotton. Well, your corn, again, we don't have any access to be able to ship it. It costs more to ship than it's worth. Corn you grow locally, but you can't float it down in flat boats and whatnot to market. But cotton is another story. Cotton is worth more per pound than any other agricultural product you could have produced in the 19th century. First settlements in Texas, believe it or not, come about in the 1815 to 1836, primarily Southerners from Tennessee, Kentucky, Arkansas, North Carolina. Anybody know where Clarksville, Texas is?
Cool.
All right, do you know where Paris, Texas is?
Vaguely.
All right. Clarksville is located about 100 and some odd miles east of Dallas, about 20 miles just on the cusp of the Red River Valley, and they call themselves the Gateway to Texas. And there's some truth to that. My wife and I have been doing a bicycle ride that's sponsored by the Clarksville Chamber of Commerce. It's a small town called the Gateway to Texas, getaway tour, small group. But Clarksville was the gateway to Texas for these early settlers who came in. Sam Houston, when he came to Texas, came through Clarksville on his way from Tennessee. After the Civil War, there was significant migration from other parts of the South. Then, from the end of the Depression, mid-Depression, to the 1960s, we had tremendous migration into Texas from the Midwest, upper Midwest, and Northeast to some extent. Again, por qué? Well, we'll tie this with economic development in Texas. As Texas began to develop after the Depression and World War II, we needed educated workers. And we hadn't produced a lot of those, not in the engineering, technical fields. And so they moved into Texas in droves and brought with them their culture and their politics to some extent. Now, Anglos have dominated the politics of Texas since its independence from Mexico in 1836. But the times, they can start to change. African Americans have inhabited Texas since Spanish rule. The Mexican government, after the Mexican Revolution, outlawed slavery. One of the bones of contention between the Texas colonists and Mexico was the fact that the economy of Texas was dependent on cotton, which was being produced by slave labor, and the Mexican government's efforts to try to eliminate slavery. The out-migration from rural to urban areas began with the Depression, and actually before, and has continued even today. Let me stop and tell you a story. I'm watching my clock real quick, carefully. Kind of the saga of the Waddells. My grandfather came to Texas in the late 1800s from Georgia. My grandmother's family had moved here a few years earlier and had settled in East Texas. Grandpa Waddell came into area around Palestine and tried to be a farmer, and frankly he was a pretty good farmer but not a very good economist, because he could grow a lot of stuff, but the same stuff he was growing, everybody else was growing, and there wasn't much market for it. So an English fella, and I worked really hard to try to find out who he was, came into that area, and he wanted to drill water wells, and he needed somebody to drill a rig. And my grandfather knew how to build almost anything. In fact, he has had two patents issued in his name. And he said, "I can build a derrick for you." Well, he built the derrick, and the guy said, "Now I need somebody to actually drill the wells." My grandfather said, "I don't know anything about drilling wells, but I can learn." And he did. And then about that time, the Goose Creek oil field opened up. Well, guess what? It was a lot better to drill oil fields than it was to drill water wells. And so he moved to the area around La Porte, Morgan's Point. That's where four of his six children were born. And when he got too old to drill water wells, he became a machinist for the Humboldt Oil and Refining Company there in Baytown. My father went to work as an office boy at the age of 17 in the Humboldt Oil and Refining Company, just after he graduated from high school. Went to Lee College, community college up there, it's a junior college. Volunteered for the Navy, served as a weatherman in World War II. Came back, studied with the GI Bill, became an engineer, chemical engineer, and pursued that profession. And then I went to college and got a degree. Now, do you see how that kind of parallels what had happened in Texas? Agriculture, skilled labor, then educated, technical. We were just one of many. Now, we have a significant Asian American population in Texas. First, interestingly enough, the first Asian Americans were probably Chinese who came in to help build railroads in the era just after the Civil War. And then we had a substantial Japanese colonization in Texas to grow rice. Now, if you're going up I-45, does everybody know where the Academy and Fry's are?
Yeah.
On I-45? What's the name of the road that runs by it?
Fry Road.
No, it's not Fry Road.
Kawabashi.
The Kawabashi family had a huge rice plantation up there, and the Kawabashi Road was named after the family. Of course, it's all subdivisions now. Move on. So when we start analyzing the population of Texas, the most significant growth among population, particularly racial ethnic minorities, has been among racial and ethnic minorities, especially Hispanics. And the Hispanic population of Texas is currently younger, less well educated, and less well economically off than the population as a whole. But this is changing. Let's take a look at how things have changed between 2000 and 2010. The non-Hispanic white population of Texas in 2000 was 53%. In 2010 census, it was 45%. The Hispanic or Latino population was 32% in 2000. It's 38% in 2010. The black population, African-American population, Afro-American population has stayed about the same. The non-Hispanic other, that's Asian American, blah, 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 went from about 4 to 6%. Well, 4 to 6% doesn't sound particularly impressive, but that's a 50% growth. Right? So tell me, Jessica, what do you think it's going to look like in 2020? That's only 5 years off. The non-Hispanic white population will probably continue to be the largest segment, but it's now less than 50%. Mm-hmm. And the demographers are looking at it. You can look to the Texas State Data Center, estimating it might be 47-48%. The Latino population between 40-42%. All right, let's jump ahead, not 5 years from now, but 15 years from now. What's the population of Texas going to look like 15 years from now?
Total chaos.
I'm serious now. Now, the rate of growth, we've already determined that the rate of growth is probably going to start to level off some.
Say about 30 million.
Which will be the, well, let's not look at just the numbers. What will be probably the majority group?
Probably Hispanics.
Yeah. Well, how could we kind of figure out what the adult Hispanic population of Texas is going to look like in 15 years? Why don't we look at public school enrollments in Texas now? How many of you are aware that non-Anglos constitute a majority of all public school students today? We don't have to guess what it's going to look like in 20 years in terms of adults. We can look at what the kids are like now. Do you think that's going to have an impact on the politics of Texas? Oh, certain why. And part of what we need to do to figure out how it is. All right, I'm taking a look. Here's an interesting chart. Notice that the African-American, Afro-American, black population probably is only going to change a little bit. This is the Asian-American population. But look at the difference between the non-Hispanic Anglo and Hispanic. If present trends continue, that's the kicker. There needs to be a big asterisk up here. Present trends continue. Is there any absolute certainty that that will occur? No. Now, one of the reasons we are pretty well sure, this is called a population pyramid. It looks at the distribution by age group, by race, ethnicity, and age group. Let me see. I picked on this side too many times. Let me try one over here. Can I pick on you for a second? Who is most likely to have children, a 20-year-old woman or a 40-year-old woman?
The 21-year-old? The 21-year-old.
Yeah. What's called natural fertility rates. If you've ever studied this, if you look at natural fertility rates, after about age 25, it begins to start to decline. And by the time you get to 30, 35, it declines rather precipitously. So a lot of these women who are in their 30s and 40s who want to have children, who haven't had children, spend a lot of money, a lot of time with fertility doctors trying to conceive. And it's not an easy task. When you were born, you had all the eggs you were ever going to have. Mm-hmm. And as they get older, they get less fertile. Off on a tangent for just a second, I had a student one time after I'd done this particular lecture came up and asked me, said, "Mr. Waddell, what would you do if you discovered your wife was pregnant?" The first thing I'd do is rechange her name to Sarah. Okay, everybody caught that? Abraham's wife, Sarah, who was way beyond the normal expected age to have children, finally conceives. I jokingly said my wife only had one hot flash. It just lasted 10 years. She is in her late, late youth. And by the time she starts drawing Social Security, she might admit she's middle-aged. So when we look at the various groups, here's the Anglos. Here's the Anglo females. Where's the biggest bulge?
50s.
Between 40 and 65, right? Is that the most fertile period?
No.
No. Take a look at Hispanic. Where's the bulge?
About 40.
Those are childbearing years, aren't they? So if we looked at no other single thing other than that chart, it would help us understand a great deal about projected population, fertility rates, and so forth in the future. Fair enough? Good. All right, we've done enough people. Where are the old folks? And why? Now, in this instance, blue means older. Percentage older in blue. The young people are in the red area, the older people are in the blue area. Notice a couple of interesting things. In the rural areas, you got a lot of blues. In West Texas, you got a lot of blues. Particularly here in the hill country where people, you know, I jokingly said the only growth industry in Blanco, Texas is the funeral home business and the nursing home business. Part of it, people moving there to retire, but also the young people have moved off and the old people stayed in their homes. Now, if we have any sort of thing we need to worry about, it's this particular chart. 43% of Hispanics in 2009 had less than a high school diploma, and only a relatively small chunk had bachelor degrees or higher, whereas among non-Hispanic whites, only 8% had less than a high school diploma, and a pretty healthy chunk had had either some college or a bachelor's degree. Now, if you're a planner, if you're looking at the economics of Texas in the future, does that bode well for Texas' economic future? If majority of your population is going to be less well educated than you need in order to sustain your economy. All right, let's deal with economic activity. I've got about 20 minutes. We're going to hit it fast, but it's okay. From the 1820s to the 1860s, cotton was the primary economic engine for Texas. Why? Well, transportation's one reason. It's the only crop you can get to market that's worth more than the cost of taking it to market. And there aren't many markets for it. You can grow all the food in the world. Remember my grandpa Waddell? He'd grow stuff left and right, but there weren't any markets for it. One story, family story that was handed down is one year my grandfather decided to grow sweet potatoes. And he had a bumper crop of sweet potatoes, but everybody else had grown sweet potatoes. There was no market for them. So they had a few dairy cows, and he decided to feed the sweet potatoes to the cows. They loved it. They loved it. There was only one downside. Can you figure what it might be? Anybody want to try? What color is milk? What color is milk if you feed the cows lots of sweet potatoes? I'm serious. There's a lot of keratin in sweet potatoes, is there not? And guess what? It comes through in the milk. Now today it would have been considered premium milk because it was that nice golden orange. So they had to make cheese and lots of it. Problem with that is once it gets hot, the cheese will spoil. Like I said, there's a reason my grandfather got out of being a farmer. cattle after the 18... Why did cattle suddenly become valuable to Texas? What made cattle valuable?
Steak.
Any idea, Carol?
Steak.
Caroline.
Isn't that right? Farming community? I have no idea.
Well, how do you get the... Texas still has a transportation problem, and if you can't get... How did we get the cows to market after the Civil War? Cattle drives. Cattle drives only lasted for about a decade until the railroads came to Texas. Now you need a market, right? The Spanish could grow cattle, I mean, had no problem with it, but there was no market. And you couldn't get them to market. Well, there was no market, first off. But after the 1860s, 70s, market develops primarily in the North and the Midwest, I mean Northeast. If you can get the cows to Kansas City, you can ship them by rail. And the tremendous urban growth that took place in the Northeast meant there was a market for protein, lots of market for protein. Hot dang. And so fortunes were made. Texas, the cattle era in Texas, now this is a trick question. When did the cattle era in Texas end?
It never did. It never did.
It hasn't ended. Fat Stock Show in Houston is an example of cattle, but as a percentage of the overall economy, it shrunk.
Right, but we're still using
as other things have grown. Cattle production, we no longer have the longhorn, we could have the improved breeds. What three things, you don't have to answer this, it's not a test question, but what three things changed the nature of the cattle market in Texas?
Slaughterhouse.
Barbed wire.
Slaughterhouses. The slaughterhouses.
Well, yeah, but the actual things that changed what kind of cows you could grow, what kind of cattle you could grow, improved breeds like Angus and so forth. Well, if you can't keep the biggest and meanest bull out of the pasture, you ain't going to have purebred cattle, right? So barbed wire, windmill. Cattle consume a lot of water. Put them out there with a windmill and confine them. They can't get to creeks, but they can get to the water basin. And then the transportation, because something like white-faced cattle can't walk 1,000 miles to market. All right. What one event, what one thing changed the nature of the Texas economy irreversibly, even down to the present time? In January 1901, in Gladys City, which is just to the east of us over near Beaumont, Captain Dan Joyner brought in Spindletop. Spindletop was a gusher. Now, we had had oil. Texas knew, they knew we had oil in Texas, but hadn't been able to be produced in commercial quantities, and there really wasn't much of a market for oil prior to that time. What created the market for oil in the early 1900s?
Trains?
No planes yet. And ships. Oil is a much safer fuel for ships than coal. Coal dust is very explosive. And a lot of freighters that were using coal, and also it is backbreaking labor to shovel that coal into the furnaces or the boilers on ships or on trains. So we discover the oil and all of a sudden the transportation industry. And then we talked about trains and ships. What's the next biggie in the transportation industry that increases the demand for oil exponentially?
Cars.
Cars, automobiles. Automobiles. Well, I've been thinking about, dreaming about automobiles since the early 19th century. But the reality was almost impossible because there was no real good fuel to fuel them. But with the discovery of oil in Texas and in other places, and then the ability to refine that oil into gasoline, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, it kind of developed simultaneously. True? Henry Ford could have built all the Model Ts in the world, and if there hadn't been gasoline to fuel them, he couldn't have given them away. And so Texas jumps into the chemical, petrochemical refining business big time. Remember, we talked about this tremendous immigration that takes place in the 40s, 50s, and 60s in Texas, directly related to the growth of chemical, petrochemical industry in Texas. Everybody comfortable with that? Yes? No? Give me a...
Yes.
Yeah. All right, then in the 1980s, a little history here. Texas was dependent, the United States was heavily dependent on oil that had been produced in the Middle East. And after the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, the Arabs decided the United States had been a little bit too friendly to the Israelis, and they embargoed the shipment of oil to the United States. This caused a tremendous crash. A tremendous boom, because the price of oil shot up to the point where anybody who could get out and borrow enough money to drill an oil well did so. And the Texas economy absolutely just boomed during the early 1970s to the mid-1970s. Then the Arabs decided that they were cutting their own throat and decided to open the spigots again. Gosh, are we seeing anything similar to that right now? The price of oil dropped from $100 a barrel down to about $40. How many oil companies in Houston have gone broke, laid off employees? Well, when the economy of Texas was 80% dependent on the chemical petrochemical industry, what do you think that tremendous crash did to the economy of Texas? I got three really sick jokes to tell you. Okay? Not dirty, just sick. How do you get a Houston oil man out of a tree? Cut the rope around his neck. What are the two things you couldn't find in Midland, Texas in 1982? A solvent bank and a U-Haul truck. Thirdly, and this is the one I like, these two girls are jogging along the jogging trail in Memorial Park in Houston, and one of them has to tie her shoe, so she bends over and she's tying her shoe, and she hears this little voice that says, "Help me, help me." She looks around, and underneath this leaf, there's a frog with a little crown on its head. So she picks up the frog, and he says, "Help me, help me. I am a Houston oil man. I have been enchanted by an evil spirit. If you kiss me, I will return to myself." She unzips her fanny pack, sticks the frog in her fanny pack, and says, "Okay, let's go." And her friend says, "You're not going to break the spell?" She said, "You've got to be kidding. A talking frog is worth so much more than a Houston oil man." There's a lot of sick humor like that in the 1980s. Now, Texas made a deliberate decision to try to diversify its economy. Electronics, biomedical. There was a great article in last Sunday's Chronicle about the oil industry in Houston and the biomedical, the medical industry, and how they compete, how right now there are multiple jobs available in the biomedical industry, and laying off people left and right in the oil industry. We look at gross state products, and I've tried to get the 2013 data, hadn't quite come out yet. Obviously, California is the number one state. New York, interestingly enough, is number two, was number two. Remember I told you that New York had a higher per capita income than Texas, but the population was stable, and then Texas. talk about primary versus secondary. Primary is what you do to bring money in. Secondary is the money that you circulate. Let's play games with that for just a second. I'm about to run out of time, but you're okay. What is the primary economic engine of Galveston?
Shipping.
Shipping? Is it as big a deal as it was 30 years ago? Nowhere close. Other than one specific form of shipping, we aren't shipping cotton anymore. We're shipping people on cruises to nowhere. I'm not going to ask you to put them in order. Just name me. Let's name some more of the primary economic activities for Texas, for Galveston.
Tourism.
Tourism, generally. It's actually not number one. Moving up, but not number one. What is numero uno for Galveston? Government employment. UTMB. Texas A&M Galveston. Galveston College. They're the primary economic engine for Galveston. Shipping is good, shipping people, tourism. The insurance industry was at one point with American National. It's still part of it, but no longer the biggie. Fair enough? Now, when we take the same look at Texas, oil is still number one in Texas, but it's no longer 80% of the economic activity like it was back before the 1980s. Maybe about 40%. Both the exploration, processing, oil, chemical, petrochemical, like. Agriculture is important. Biomedical is important. Other kinds of fields. If we break this out, I haven't gotten the most recent data. They only do this survey every 10 years, unfortunately. Notice that the white-collar jobs now outnumber the blue-collar jobs. Does that have some sort of a significance when we start talking about the educational system of Texas?
Yes.
If we know that Texas ranks 45th in terms of education, is that something that should give us pause if the biggest single area of our economy is in the area of white-collar jobs? Hopefully, yes. We are number two in terms of agricultural production. Probably going to decline with the contest for water. Farms are getting larger, more specialized, more use of agriculture, irrigation, chemicals, pesticides, and lots of money necessary to do it. Mining, Texas is still number one in terms of oil and gas production, but that's declining and has really hit a hole now with the surplus. Poverty is more pronounced in Texas than the nation as a whole. We rank 50th in the nation in percentage of high school graduates, 45th in percentage of college graduates. 26% of Hispanics live in poverty, 21% of African Americans, only 8% of Anglos. Look at median income. I don't want to spend too much time on this, to be honest with you. We talk about the change in economic equality over the years. Fascinatingly enough, if we look between 1980 and 2000, the wealth disparity has gotten greater in Texas than it was 20 years ago. Is that a question, something that we need to be concerned about? And what do we do about it? And how do we do something about it? Is there a connection between our educational status and this distribution? Now, if you haven't had enough data, if you are just underwhelmed with data, you can go to either of these two websites and over OD on data. Have a good one. I will see you next week.